Namaste and in La Ketch, and welcome to this week's episode of One World and New World. I'm your host, Zen Benefiel, and this week's guest is a very special man. His name is David Doyer, and he has been telling everyone how to present better so that your message could be understood and heard by your audience. He says that talking and telling ain't training or selling. He's a public speaking and facilitator, a voiceover coach, and he's been doing things in radio for several decades. He's retired from the United States Air Force. Thank you for your service. And he talks about facilitation, adult learning, public speaking, presentation skills, and instructional design. He is a presentation empowerment coach with Present Your Way to Success. He's an e-learning voiceover and development person for elearningvoiceover.com. He's a program director and owner of Classic Long Island Radio Program. And he's a volunteer mentor for Hire Heroes. And he's also had some interesting education from the Air Force and logistics and training, and from an organization near and dear to my heart, the American Society for Training and Development. David, pleasure to have you here.
Well, thank you so much.
I hope I did you justice.
Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate that introduction, and thank you so much for inviting me to be a part of your podcast. I'm excited to be here today.
Well, I am too, David. Thank you very much. So generally, we talk about the development of your inner awareness. And some of us start very young, some, you know, teenage, some later on, some midlife, some even in just the last few years, if you can imagine that. So I'm curious as to, I know with what you're doing and how you're doing things and encouraging and empowering people to get up and speak and connect with their audiences, that there's got to be some inner drive in there. And did you have experiences when you were younger that kind of allowed you to be aware that there's more to life than just the outer experience and that you had an interconnection to it?
You know, that's a great question. You know, my simple answer is no. When I was a kid, I was a shy little pimply kid growing up on Long Island, New York. I knew something just wasn't quite right with my connection with my family. I didn't feel connected. Something was missing. The only thing that I had a passion for, that I had an interest in, was radio. I grew up with a transistor, went to sleep every night with a little transistor radio underneath my pillow, and just was fascinated with radio. Mm-hmm. There were some things from my childhood that I would say PTSD from childhood, early childhood, being neglected and not feeling connected to anyone within the family. But there was that something about radio that had me fascinated. And when I was in my junior year in high school, the semester of English focused completely on media. I was not very good in school, but this particular semester, I aced it. I got an A in that English class because we focused on TV, radio, broadcasting, and I even had to do a little radio play of some sort.
Oh, that's and awesome.
I was just fascinated. So it was later on that I had a chance to finally get into radio. But as a kid, no, I the only thing I knew when I graduated high school was I didn't want to go to college. I had no desire to go back to school. I was not good in school, but I'm very fortunate that I went into the Air Force and I found a career that I really loved, and it was part of my life for 28 years.
And a lot of camaraderie and friendships and lifelong friendships evolved from those kinds of engagements, and especially in the service, because you're there to support each other as much as anything.
Yeah.
You know, it's fascinating that I remember the transistor radios when I was a kid too. I never had one under my pillow, But I would imagine it kind of gave you almost an escape, being able to listen to the radio and just kind of let yourself go and feel connected in some other way outside of your family dynamic.
Yeah, you know, that's interesting you say that. We were talking beforehand that I was on a podcast and had a couple of ahas, and that's an aha for me because I'm very visual in my head. And one of the things that I would see in my head was, how does this radio station have all of these bands in that building? There must be this huge building, and on every one of those floors, there must be this band, and then they play that, they cue them and they play the song. So yeah, it was that, that escape. I envisioned that band was in that building, radio station, playing the music live.
There's a lot of bandwidth there, isn't there?
Exactly.
Right. And you know, your experience in English, I had a similar one. We did our English presentation my senior year. Actually, I did one on the Scarlet Letter, and I used Magician's Birthday by Uriah Heep as the background music. It was, I had a blast. And of course, I got an A in it as well. I think I was the only one in class that combined the rock and roll with the English assignment, but it was fun. And you know, that having a voice and being able to hear someone else, you know, different radio announcers have different energy with their audience, but some of them are really great, intriguing, get you to ask questions and think for yourself a little bit more. Speaking of thinking for yourself, once you got into the military and had your progression there, what was there something that drew you back inside at some point to begin, you know, questioning that connection again?
Yeah, that's a great question. So when I went in the Air Force, it was 1976. I went through my basic training at Lackland Air Force Base in Texas, went to schooling in Texas. And then my first assignment was Guam. All of the insecurities, all of those negative voices that were in my head completely disappeared. I guess they disappeared immediately after going into the Air Force, because you're thrown into a situation.
You don't have time for them anymore, right?
Yeah, you're thrown into a situation where all of you got to come together and work together, because if one person screws up, you all are punished.
Right. And of the 70,000 thoughts a day we have, most of them being self-deprecating, until we get in an experience like that, then those disappear. It's it's like it's an automatic. Now your attention, intention, and interaction is totally focused.
Exactly. Yeah.
Very little downtime.
So I never really, it just kind of disappeared. It wasn't until later that I thought about it. Well, wait a minute, where were those voices? And so when I went to my first assignment in Guam, again, it was so much new. Here you are on the other side of the world. I never heard of Guam before. And now I took, it wasn't my first airplane ride, but it was certainly my longest airplane ride, to go from New York all the way to California, and then to Guam. And I met up with a very tight group of guys. I wouldn't say I was the leader of these four or five guys, but I had the car. So I was the guy that was driving us down to all the bars and the hotels to go swimming in the pool.
You were the roadie for the band, right?
Exactly. Exactly. But where those voices came back was, you know, one of the things that happens when you're overseas, that you have a what's called a DEROS, a date estimated return overseas. Everybody goes over. We were all single, so we were all there for 15 months. All of us in our little tight group, we all arrived at different times. So we were all had different dates of when we would be leaving. And so one of our guys in the group, he left. It was part of, he was, his 15 months was up. And then all of a sudden, wham, it just, those voices, those insecurities, it all just came back. It was that loss. It wasn't a death, but it was certainly something like a death where he's gone.
Right. Do you remember what any of those utterings were?
I guess I don't remember the utterings of I remember the feeling was the insecurities, doubting my abilities, feeling alone, lonely, missing something, losing a connection, similar to what I was feeling when I was a kid before I went in the service.
Sure. Oh yeah. And they're going to bring up those kinds of feelings because it's a similar situation, right? And you hadn't had, for lack of a better, I'll call it the emotional maturity to recognize that, realize, oh, okay, this is just part of the process and I'll get through it and everything will be okay.
Right. Right.
Hopefully.
Yeah. And so this was like 9 or so months after I arrived, 9 months of being a really cohesive unit with the four of us. I mean, we were doing everything together. We were roommates. We were going everywhere together. We just couldn't get enough of each other. We had a great time all the time, going to the movies, going walking, going to the beach every day. And then all of a sudden, whammo, it was like the carpet was pulled out from underneath me.
Mm-hmm. So what'd you do about that?
I think I just, again, I didn't have the maturity that I have now. This is back in 1977-ish in there.
So late teens.
Late teens, I maybe 19, 20 years old at the time. And I just withdrew.
Mm-hmm.
I went in. I had all those self-doubts about myself, that I wasn't good enough. I wasn't smart enough. I wasn't X enough. You fill in the blank.
Right. Yeah, that's a tough place to be. And as a teenager, I know I spent those years in college and I had a spiritual awakening that I mentioned to you earlier. One of the things that happened of that was my sensitivity was just blown open to the point where I was walking back from the cafeteria one day and walking past other students fairly close, right past, not that wide, and I would hear all of these self-deprecating messages that would start with you. Right, so I'm hearing all these different voices, not my own voice, but I'm hearing these voices ripping themselves up saying you first. So I'm thinking it's all about me. And so I locked myself in the dorm room for 3 days until a friend of mine comes and says, hey, where you been? What's going on? I'm worried about you. And I told him what had happened. And he said, well, those your voice or others? And I said, well, they were others. And when I spoke the words, I got out of my head, right? And I spoke the words, the insight was instantaneous that wasn't me. I was just hearing others and, oh my gosh, how can we all, be going through this? And as a teenager, that's really, especially in college, right? You want to do your best. You don't feel like you're enough, can do enough, be enough, all of those kinds of same things you were feeling, but nobody talked to about. We're just, digging in and getting through it. So how did you finally recognize this or these patterns within you and begin to ascend from that? Was there another trigger? Was there an insight? Did you have a prayer that was answered, or how did you approach that?
Well, I have to say that it really was, there were little steps along the way. It took many, many, many years of self-discovery, of building, of understanding that everything that I need was within myself or is within myself. I spent years of looking externally for gratification, whether it was I had to have that relationship to feel complete. Without that relationship, I'm not complete. I guess the big aha came when I realized my mother was a narcissist and realized how that influenced me as a child. there were little signs along the way. Now, I'm talking years here.
Sure.
And there were signs along the way.
Well, none of this happens overnight. It takes, you know, years, sometimes decades.
Yeah. There were little signs along the way that something wasn't right. So I'm on my third marriage. And when I left my second marriage, I knew at some point I would be getting out of that marriage. And I knew that when I do it, my mother would divorce me.
Hmm.
And so that's exactly what happened.
Let me put this on pause for just a second. I'm curious. How did you know? What was the sense? Because the reason I'm drawing this out is because we do have this direct connect, right? We have access to infinite intelligence that's specific for us. And there was a guy a couple thousand years ago said the same thing. You know, mm-hmm. you have a direct connect, just go inside and, you know, pick up the phone,
mm-hmm.
call home.
Mm-hmm.
So how did that
I believe I have a sixth sense of some sort. There's been so many little signs along the way during my life that have given me signs of just giving me signs. For example, when I was a child, my tonsils were growing down my throat and I was having trouble at times swallowing. Hmm. And there was this one day that I couldn't eat and couldn't swallow the food. And my mother told me, well, go upstairs and lay down. So I was laying on my bed and I heard voices or a voice come out of the closet that just said my name, David. It freaked me out enough. Now I'm 9-ish, 8-ish, somewhere in there. It freaked me out enough that I ran downstairs crying to my mother that I heard this voice. My thinking is that maybe it was something, because if I had laid there, maybe I would have choked to death. I don't know. That has stuck with me ever since.
Or maybe there would have been a developing conversation. I had a similar thing when I found out I was adopted. I had the questions. You know, my parents told me about it when my sister arrived. I was about 4 and a half. And within a month or so, the questions I had beyond the, well, why, who are they, you know, all the kind of stuff was, do I have a father and mother in heaven and can I talk to them?
Mm-hmm.
And so one night I'm standing on the landing of the stairway with my elbows in the windowsill, looking out across the front porch after dark. And all of a sudden I hear this big booming voice and it simply says, hey, you.
Mm.
And instead of talking, instead of saying, huh, who, me, right? I knew I heard it. I spun around immediately and asked my mother if she heard it too. Of course, she didn't.
Mm.
But at that point, you know, she says, no, I didn't hear your voice. Must have been a peeping Tom. So, you know, kind of sloughed it off. I knew what I heard, though. And over the next, probably several months, I would stand in front of the windows at night and project this same voice out. You know, lights on inside, reflection on the window, can't see out. So there's this unknown beyond the window, right? And I would send this voice out and I would stand there and hope, wait for it to come back. Well, as long as I was thinking, waiting, I couldn't hear it. It was when I finally shut this up, my head, right? I stopped thinking that I heard it.
Mm.
So I then, you know, I got this insight of, oh, you got to shut up in order to listen. Wow, what a novel idea, right? And as a little kid, it's hard to shut up. Still, as an adult, it's hard to shut up and go to that depth of quiet just to be present and listen. So that voice you heard could have had all kinds of things. Fact is, you remember hearing it, and it was distinct enough that you know you did.
Yep, and I still can hear it to this day. I can still visualize myself in that bed. I can still visualize where that voice, the closet, where it came from, all of those feelings I can bring back.
Go in your closet and pray, right? Still,
and then the second,
developed a conversation with it.
Yeah. And then I had a second one when I was a teenager. This was before I could drive. A friend of mine and I were at the beach long before cell phones. and the place is crowded. It's a summer on Fire Island. And I said to him, well, what if my mother or somebody needed to get in touch with me? How could they do that? And he said, what are you talking about? Come on, David, let's get back into the water and go chase the girls. So we finished our day at the beach. I get home. There's nobody home except for my grandmother. My father's mother lived with us. And she says, well, where have you been all day? Everybody's been looking for you because your grandfather, my mother's father, had died. And everybody packed up in the car and they left, but they couldn't get in touch with me. So I had this thought in my head, well, what if something goes on and someone needs to get in touch with me? So, you know, there were other little things that would happen along the way. I'd be thinking of something. I'd look at a billboard and I'd see exactly the same word I was thinking of. I'd think of a number in my head. I look at a billboard or look at a sign and I'm seeing exactly the same thing that was just in my head. So how did I know that my mother would divorce me? I don't know, but somehow I knew it. I felt it and I knew it was going to happen and it happened.
And those kinds of things are, I find, part and parcel to this inner awareness that you begin to trust, right? There's this sense, we don't know where it all comes from. All we know in quantum physics now, right? Now that we have this, that everything's energy. We are energy. We look like we're physical, but when it gets down to the, you know, micro level, we're not. We're little tickly lines of energy that are vibrating. So it would stand to reason then that this communication, that our attention both is directed to and evidence of what we're thinking or what is being presented to us to consider, whether it's, you know, from our own mind or from someone else, or, you know, in your case, when there's a family emergency and you have this sense of something's going on, but you're not quite sure what it was. And yet, and then you find out, oh, well, that's what was happening, right? Now, as you got older and developed this, as you got in more into your radio career and in that part of life, did you find that there was a more of a depth in this understanding and navigation and even conversation with this internal sense that you had?
Great question. So my timeline with radio, I did 10 years active duty in the military and then came off active duty and went into the reserves. And I was in the reserves for 18 years. And the reason I made that transition was because of radio. I started part-time radio when I was active duty on Guam the second time. And what I recall happening was those voices, those negative voices, the judgment was there. I remember having the headphones on, hearing my own voice coming through the microphone, but at the same time, I was envisioning a doctor, lawyer, learned type of person pointing at the radio and laughing and calling me an idiot. But there was this, you know, I've said this many
functional
times.
At least, right?
A functional idiot. Yes. But I must have had that internal drive because I didn't give up. I did what I could to get better. Those voices, yes, it took years for those voices to slowly shrink. And I had those voices show up again when I started community theater a few years later, that when I was on stage, it wasn't the character on stage. It was David on stage spitting out words that, and again, the voices and the judgment, feeling the audience was criticizing me and judging me. And it was a magical moment when all of that went away. So I think what was inside of me was this, there was a drive that I'm going to work through this thing that I don't even know if I gave it much thought. I just knew that I had to continue to do this because I loved radio and I still love radio and I loved what I was doing in community theater. I was mm-hmm. good at it. And
right. And that's a point, mm-hmm. right? I want to draw on that for just a moment, because in this constant onslaught of these self-deprecating voices, when you look around at what's going on around you, everything's okay.
Mm-hmm.
They love
mm-hmm.
you.
Mm-hmm.
You're having this success, you're enjoying yourself. And so there's really no reason
mm-hmm.
to have these voices, because there's nothing to be fearful of
yeah.
in your outer world at that point. It's all an internal thing. Now, that doesn't make it go away. What it does is it gives you a way to reflect on, okay, well, this is going inside of me. What's going on outside of me that
mm-hmm.
shows a disparity between the two, first of all.
Mm-hmm.
And then how were you able, or were you able to talk to others in the process about similar things going on inside of them at that point? I know later that happened, but in that, how did that first begin?
You know, I never did talk to anyone. I get so it, let's yeah focus on the radio. One of the fortunate things I had from the very beginning was working with a great program director that was very supportive, that even though I was part-time originally at the station, we would sit down at least once a month. We would listen to my air checks, the recordings that I recorded myself all the time. And I have my very first recording. It sounds very unique, very different than how I sound today, but he would give me great feedback and how to take, instead of saying this number of words to say something, he would help me to say, let's use this number of words to say the same thing, encouraging me, helping with my breath control and mm-hmm. giving me positive feedback. So I was getting that while I was learning radio, reading a lot about radio. I learned radio and theater by the seat of my pants. And in theater, I was getting feedback from directors, but I never talked to, other than the director, other than my program director, I really never talked to anybody else about what was going on inside mm-hmm. of me. But I didn't even talk to them.
The generation prior, where that really wasn't the thing to do. And if you did, you mm-hmm. were putting yourself in jeopardy and the potential of being mm-hmm. carted off.
Yeah, carted off. Yeah. Yeah. And I never opened up to them what was going on inside of me. I was just being receptive to whatever feedback that they were giving me, you know, because one of the things I learned from a fellow actor and now with my wife now is that, and I'm sure this is true. And this is true with everybody, because I give people feedback on their presentation skills.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we do a good job of tearing ourselves apart. I know I was judging myself very differently,
right?
But people's perception of me was so much different than what I perceived of myself. But that's not me, that's everybody,
right?
Yeah,
and that's a great point, too, because the feedback we get when we do is usually vastly different than what's going on inside of our heads. And mm-hmm. when we begin to listen, right, that those voices begin to dissipate, because, oh, it's like, oh, okay, I am getting things across and I am articulating appropriately and people are understanding me and we're connecting and they're mm-hmm. hearing me and responding to let me know that they are. You know, it's funny how you mentioned the simple experiences that we have that really, to fully explain them, take volumes
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
to go in all the different areas of what occurs during that period. And I think that's one of the difficulties in all the ancient texts that we have, right? We've had people that have had experiences and then, how do I explain this? Well, I'm going to try it this way. Oh, I'm going to try it this way too. And I think I'll try it this way. And maybe somebody will hear one of those ways.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, what you're talking, there's that double-edged sword that I was getting this feedback but it was difficult for me to absorb all of it, especially when it was positive. Where in community theater, for example, there we would, at the end of the show, we would stand at the door, all of us actors, and we would shake everybody's hand as they were leaving to thank them for coming out and supporting the theater group and getting that positive feedback from the audience, that I just couldn't take it in. And that goes back to, you know, I've learned this from therapy, that as a child, I couldn't come home and talk about this exciting thing that happened to me. I'm the oldest of five, that if I was to express this joy, my siblings would call me an idiot, that, you're still an idiot. And I couldn't also express that I made a mistake, or I couldn't demonstrate that I made a mistake, because if I made it, if my siblings caught on to that, again, you're an idiot, you made a mistake. Mm-hmm. So all I did was just shut down. I couldn't take in joy. I couldn't express disappointment. So now people are telling me, they're showering me with, oh, you should be on Broadway. You should be this. You should be that. You did a great job. You did this. Yeah. All right. Yeah. Thanks a lot. Yeah. Okay. Thanks. Yeah. Just couldn't take it in.
Not believing a word of it. Yeah. Isn't it funny how, you know, we seek approval, acknowledgement, acceptance. And then when we get it, it's like, oh, that doesn't, you know, it just doesn't sit well initially. It's hard to take.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think that we are so reluctant to accept compliments and praise?
Well, maybe I'll get to that, you know, starting with this, that in okay. my case, it goes back to hearing my mother's voice of don't show off. Don't embarrass me. It was that we, all of us kids, had to just be quiet over in the corner whenever we went out. We were little angels, the five of us, when we would go to someone's house. My mother would get compliments from the lady of the house saying, boy, you've got the best kids. But as soon as we got home, we were killing each other. We were right. throwing stuff at each other. You name it, we were doing it. But when we were out in public, somehow we learned never to show off, never to speak up, never to embarrass my mother. So maybe it comes from, in my case, that when I'm up on stage, yes, I'm now the center of attention, and now people are showering me with their compliments, and I can't take it in because I can't show off.
So is there anything really wrong with showing off?
Well, I guess no.
What is showing off? Is that, you know, being true to who you are and having fun and enjoying the moment?
Mm-hmm.
You know, for me, that seems like that's kind of the epitome of life, is having the joy, having the fun, the expression in whatever you're doing, right? Yeah. Especially as an actor. Right. Mm-hmm. You've got to step into that part and become someone else for a little bit. So that's kind of really fun, because you get to, you know, create an alter ego that then you can play around with for a bit. Speaking of alter egos, did you ever bring any of that back into your own life as a result?
I think I do when I'm training and when I'm speaking in front of others. That's a career that popped up into my life unexpectedly. You know, radio popped up into my life unexpectedly. Theater, so it was one day I was a buddy of mine that was in radio on Guam. One day he just threw a script in my lap and said, here, you got the lead in the next dinner theater that we're doing. We open in a month, so study your lines. That's how I got started in theater. And once I was on that stage, I found that I loved it. And what I've learned about myself is that, and I've learned this about other actors from watching that program a few years ago called The Actor's Studio, that actors are more comfortable on stage than they are with small talk. And I would say that alter ego comes in when I'm up in front of folks training them, or if I'm up on stage portraying a character, or when I'm coaching somebody. Yes.
Does that alter ego sometimes feel more authentic than your real self?
I think that that alter ego has, over the years, gotten closer and closer and closer to who I am, because I've been able to release so much over the years. And part of it, maybe we'll get to that discussion about my mother with the narcissism.
We'll get there in just a minute. In that process of the two coming together and finally finding home within you to be able to express yourself authentically, how did that first arrive, and what did you notice in how you were transforming in the process?
Well, I think one of the ways was getting involved in the men's group at a local church. It's not, mm-hmm. Some of the guys are members of the church. Many of us are not members of the church, but this men's group has been together for about 30 years, and I've been with them for probably 10 or so years. And the thing that I took away from there, because I thought that I was the only guy that felt this way. I was the only guy that had these kind of thoughts. I'm the only guy that had, you name it. I'm the only guy. Everybody else is normal, and I'm the only crazy person in the world. Well, guess what? I learned quickly that everybody in that room with my men's group, we're all just as crazy as each other. And learning that I'm just like them, and being accepted by them, that was a big aha for me.
So did that come about through the conversations that you all were able to have and be able to share on a more vulnerable, intimate level, mm-hmm. in that environment?
Yeah, it's a very intimate group inside that room. It's a very safe place. What is said in there stays in there. There's a lot of trust in there. A lot of guys would come and visit the group, and they'd never come back because they would see how open and vulnerable that we would get. And I would assume that that's not very comfortable for some men to be in that situation. But for me, I have found it's okay. It's one of the things that I teach when I train people to be trainers, is that one of the principles of engagement is the principle of effect, which is creating an environment that's free from fear. So in that training environment, the facilitator has to do, there's a number of things that they can do to create an environment that's going to be where people feel safe.
Right. Isn't that the kind of the end all or the end result of faith, love, and trust, is mm-hmm. being able to be vulnerable in the fearlessness that presents?
Yeah, but it's a very new concept for I would think,
for many,
because some of these guys, we would promote it at the church and say, come on, guys, come and visit, come check us out. We've got this thing every Thursday night at 7:30. We go out to dinner beforehand. We've got a close group of guys. Come check us out. They'd come one time. We never see them again.
Now, are there, I belong to a bunch of different groups as well, and I'm one that I tend to be one of the most open and vulnerable in the group. But by example, I figured, I have to be if I'm inviting others to be. And so I'll be a little more so in order to do that, to show that, yeah, it's okay. I feel safe in saying this, and you can too. Do you feel that, or have you experienced that there's generally a few who kind of maintain that ambiance in the room by opening up and speaking amongst themselves to give others the opportunity to do so, whether they choose to or not, it's a different story, but they at least have that sense where they can begin to reflect on what's going on inside of them just by hearing the conversations.
So if I understand the question correctly, the core group of guys, which is about 15 of us, that every week's a little bit different. Maybe one week someone may not talk much, but on average, everybody has opened up at some point and has gotten and has been able to be vulnerable. The meeting is kind of run. It's not an AA meeting or a support mm-hmm. group meeting, but it's run very similar to how an AA or an NA meeting is run. And one of the things that you would see is that when someone is speaking, we allow them to speak and not be interrupted. So there's that trust, and there's that that we will listen to what you have to say, and we will not interrupt you. So was that what you were asking?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, to have that kind of facilitation. You know, I find it in groups, depending on the size, there's usually a core group, and it could be two or three, or it could be 15 in your case, that kind of carry the torch, if you will.
Yep. And then some weeks they may be quieter than others. And the other part of the format is that each week, someone within the group volunteers to bring in a topic of mm-hmm. whatever. And I always like to find a TED talk, an appropriate TED talk of some sort, and show the video, and then we'd have a discussion about it.
Oh, those are perfect. Right. The nice, short,
yeah,
usually deep, and brings up a lot of stuff for folks to have a discussion about. Wonderful experiences. Now, you were talking about your mother and how that the narcissism helped facilitate an ego leap, I'll call it an evolutionary leap in yourself, when you came to recognize that, and or I think there was something else that you wanted to say about that. So what did you find in that, and how did it help set you free?
Well, after I divorced my second wife, before I met my now third wife, there was definitely a change in my mother's attitude toward me. My mother was supporting my ex-wife. There was never any compassion shown toward me, nothing to have an understanding. Why did you get a divorce? There was all I saw was just my mother was supporting my ex-wife. In my mind, I just couldn't figure it all out. My relationship, because let me back up a little bit and say that when I divorced my first wife, I started back in the 80s, that I was, for the first time in my life, I was reaching out to my mother. I was talking to my mother. I was living in California. She was in Florida. And I was being vulnerable to my mother.
At a safe distance.
Well, it had nothing to do with that. I was at a point in my life, I was allowing myself to be vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even if she was in the same room with me, I think I would have been feeling the same way initially.
Good.
And because I never opened up when I was a kid. But here I'm being vulnerable. I'm crying to my mother. And every time I started talking about myself, the conversation went right back to her. And I did that maybe two or three times. And then all of a sudden I'm saying, what's going on here? I didn't even know the word narcissism. I couldn't even, if you asked me to spell it back then, I couldn't even spell it.
Mm-hmm.
So then I met my second wife, and then it wasn't until my second wife and I, we were married for 7 years. And, you know, I guess after we divorced, it occurred to me that my second wife and my mother are twins, and that, and my mother took in my ex-wife and like I said, got rid of me.
Right. There's a, I guess, a philosophy, or at least a thought anyway, of you marry your mother, right? That as guys, we generally marry our mothers.
Well, I married my mother the second time around. The first time was a young lady I met while I was stationed in Korea. So if it was my mother, she was an Oriental, you know. So anyway, but yes, I married my mother the second time.
No cultural or ethnic distinction, right?
I don't even know what I said. You can edit that out. anyway, the so we were spending a lot of time. At this point, I was living here in Georgia with my wife, my mother, and her now husband. My father passed away in the mid-80s. She married a great guy, Walter, that I love to death. And we were spending a lot of time with them. We were driving down to Florida. They were driving up here. I was feeling really close to my mother during those years that when I was married. And then I divorced. And then all of a sudden, it was like a guillotine. Something mm-hmm. happened here that, and I didn't know what it was. And I kept saying, what is it that I did wrong? Now when I met my now wife, my mother right off the bat didn't like her, because the first time my wife saw my mother, my wife could see right through her. She knew what was going on. My wife said, yeah, I can see it. I didn't see it yet. And that's when even more tension, like, what can I do to fix this? What have I done wrong? What do we have to say? What do I have to do to make this better? Long story short, when did the aha happen? I was visiting my mother's younger brother. She only has the one sibling. And he's saying to us, well, your mother called the other day. My mother called him the other day and was asking about you guys coming to visit us. And then your mother said, well, Donna, my wife's name, said, well, good luck. Nobody can stand her. She said that to my uncle. And so my uncle said two things after that. He said, well, number one, if your mother hates her, we know we're going to love her. And number two, the other thing that happened at that exact moment, 1,000,000 pounds lifted from my shoulders. And for the first time, I realized it's not me that's the problem. It's my mother that's the problem. For that was the first time that I said, there was a lot more therapy that had to happen after that. Sure. But that was the giant aha. A couple of days later, it happened to be New Year's Day that I called her a couple of days later. I don't want to say I confronted her, but I said some things to her where she automatically started defending herself. And I knew that she hit some buttons. Yep. And right there, she knew I caught her with her pants down. And at that point, what I've learned, narcissists will go into defense mode. And she put up all of her defenses and said everything and anything she could say to discredit me, discredit her brother.
Mm-hmm.
She never talked to her brother again for, I think, 10 years until she was on her deathbed. And because she blamed her brother for telling me what he told me and ruining the relationship between me and my mother. Even when my cousin, my uncle's son, died, my mother didn't even reach out to say anything.
You know, it's really unfortunate and sad that people allow themselves, out of their own fear of acceptance, right, or rejection, and they take on these personas, which are really just tough to get through. And no matter, it seems like, how you speak to or embrace or act towards them, there's always that edge that doesn't seem to ever disappear. And like you said, nothing you did or could do would ever change that for her. That's an inner exploration and realization that she needs to have on her own. And the fact that you were having it really gave you an opportunity to open that door and realize, oh, I am okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I am, you know, there are others like me, mm-hmm. and they enjoy me,
yep.
for
yep.
who I am. And your wife's a special person too, to be able to say, okay, I see this, and then help move you into a place that you wanted to be and support you in doing so. Yeah. I mean, that's just a godsend in relationships, because most of us don't have that.
Well, luckily my wife stuck it out, because it took a few years for me to see it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was defending my mother during a number of years, I was sticking up for my mother. I was putting my mother ahead of my then girlfriend, then wife. And if things had continued the way they were, we would have ended up getting a divorce because I couldn't see it. I kept thinking, what do I need to do to fix this? It's me.
It's a guy thing. We got to fix everything, right?
Yes, exactly.
It's our job. We're fixers.
Yeah. And I want to go back to something that you said about, you know, one of the things I learned about narcissism is that a traditional narcissist is not going to admit that they've made a mistake or admit that they've got to make a change. And I think maybe because it's my mother, maybe it's because I have a sixth sense of some sort. I believe that in some ways my mother knew maybe some things just weren't right, but she couldn't allow herself to admit that she needed to make a change. She couldn't allow it.
Well, patterns are habit forming, right? When you get into those patterns and yeah. you're so unconscious in them, it's hard to break them unless you got somebody slapping you upside the head with a cosmic tube before or something, if you're not paying attention. Mm-hmm. And that eventually does happen if you are at least beginning to question why.
Right.
Right. Yeah. But you have to have that question first, because if you're not questioning things, there's no inquiry, there's no curiosity, there's probably not going to be any change either.
Yeah.
Unless it comes through some catastrophic event.
Yep.
The universe steps up and said, okay, we're done with this. Yep. You need to grow up.
Well, I think there was the catastrophic event, but prior to that, she had no reason to change. Mm-hmm. Her husband, again, Walter, both now my mother and Walter are both deceased now, but that Walter was a gem. Walter, he kissed her feet. He took care of her, made her breakfast every morning. He took good care of her. And I love Walter, loved him. And maybe there was also a connection between Walter and myself because we had the same birth date, not the same year, but the same birth date.
I'm curious.
What date?
Yeah.
November 25th.
Okay.
I'll give you another whammy. There was a young lady I was dating a few years before I dated my wife. Her birthday and my mother's birthday were the same day, June 2nd. And at that same time, my mother was married to Walter. So my birthday, my mother's husband's birthday, November 25th. My mother's birthday, my girlfriend's birthday, June 2nd. What are the chances of that? And then when that
are there, right? So this brings up an interesting point. You were talking about the synchronicities earlier, right? And being, you know, paying attention to what's going on around you. It is unmistakably poignant that these things are congruent. There's nothing created, very little created. There's some things are random, right? Because, however, in the constructs of relationships and our ebb and flow and our movement through them as we're attempting to find that whole place in life, or even, you know, far be it from us that we might finally figure out that we actually have a genetic and solar frequency that's aligned with a perfected form, fit, and function that we can step into if we're able to acquiesce to it, right? That takes a lot of really deep releasing and curiosity to creating flow, and then being even more vigilant in paying attention to the serendipitous synchronicities as they occur and stepping into them, not just noticing them, right? It's one thing to notice them. It's another to engage them. Have you been able to engage more of those serendipitous synchronicities as you've transcended out of this place that you were in?
Oh, yeah, I would say so, yes. I had a substance abuse problem. I went to rehab 2 years ago, almost two years ago.
Well, that's the behaviors that generally creep in. Mm-hmm. From that kind of relationship disconnect.
Yeah.
Right? Because you're looking to either numb out or really find something that gives you a sense, even false sense, of connection.
Exactly. So since then, being clean now for almost 2 years, Labor Day will be 2 years. And so,
congratulations.
So thank you. You know, there was a long period of my life that I felt that I couldn't survive without substance.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife would threaten to leave, and I was willing to give her up.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, sure, leave. Go ahead. I'm going to continue. There's no way that I can survive without this substance. There's no way. I can't survive. I can't do anything without it. I was kind of a closet substance user. There were folks close to me that never knew that I was using.
Right.
People that we would vacation with, people that we would.
Well, functional addicts get away with everything because they are so good at hiding it and so good at pretending to be functional.
I was great. I'm a great actor.
Yeah.
I'm great at it.
You had good training from stage, right?
Exactly. So, and since then, now being clean for 2 years, and I'm doing it all. It's all me. There's nothing influencing me other than within internal motivation that's influencing me. So there's definitely been quite a change of how I view myself, how I think of myself. I was talking to somebody about this the other day. It's it's more than just rehabilitation. I've had a rebirth.
Right. There's freedom.
Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely. It's a rebirth. And I want to congratulate you personally, because even, you know, especially at our age, we are so locked into our behaviors and our patterns and things, and it's so difficult for change to take place. So I honor that you had that determination and you did it, right? Mm-hmm. And that if you can do it, others can too, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Doesn't matter what your age is. We tend to go through those kinds of things younger. However, by the time you get to be our age, those patterns are generally ingrained and we don't even want to consider that we've got a problem.
Yeah. 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 Yes. In some ways, I knew I had a problem, but I wasn't strong enough to say, I got to get rid of this, because once I reached that peak, then I'm saying to myself, I got to stop. But once I came down, I got to use. And then it was this unbelievable roller coaster. I can't tell you how many times I would reach that peak. I would flush stuff down the toilet, not immediately, but as soon as I came down off that high, I regret it. Then I got to go find more stuff. And it was just this unbelievable roller coaster. And I got to a point one day. There were periods of time I would call my therapist and say, I got to make a change. And then I come off that high and say, not today. Then I would, there were a number of those days. I'd call a friend who was big in AA and I'd say, I got to make a change. And she'd take me to an AA meeting, or she took me to an NA meeting, and it doesn't stick. It just didn't do anything. And just there was finally one day that I said something.
It won't stick until you are ready to make the change. Yep. Nobody can tell you anything else. It's mm-hmm. got to be a choice, like everything in life.
Yep.
Right? We have choices in every moment, even in how we're listening to someone. Right? Mm-hmm. We can choose to listen with biased ears and be critical and judgmental of all the words coming out and even be argumentative. Mm-hmm. Or we can do what seems to be on the trend now, or trending now, and that's active listening.
What?
Yeah, exactly. And so we're, you know, you just kind of sit, like you're talking about your group, right? You sit quietly, you listen, and you're curious. You think you hear one thing. Well, let's check. Maybe what I'm thinking isn't really what they were saying, and I want to make sure that I understand what they're saying, because I heard it this way. Is that really what you meant?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And just having those interactive, and we are so much in a rush to get from one place to another, that we don't take the time to slow down and have those conversations.
Yeah.
And it's funny how it's cropping up in business, this new catchphrase, slow down to go fast.
Gosh, it's kind of like
that novel idea.
It's like I've termed it and I'm sure others have heard it, the microwave syndrome, that we want everything fast. You know, it's only within the United States do we have drive-throughs, because we got to get that food that much faster. We can't take the time to get out of the car, to walk into the place, to order it, because we got to get through that drive-through faster. And same with the phones. You know, I made this observation today on my walk. I have a school bus stop right out in front of the place. And the school bus stop today looks so much different than it was when we were kids. When we were kids, we were all at the bus stop, all the kids in the neighborhood, interacting with each other,
making fun of each other.
Exactly.
Whatever. Yeah.
Here you got five kids standing around.
Their phones.
Yep. The two boys are seated. The three girls are standing. I was raised, even though I had problems as a kid, I was raised to be a gentleman. I'm going to open a door for a lady.
Chivalry is not dead.
Yep. I'm going to give them a seat on the bus. Everybody's on their phones. They're all in their own little worlds. They're not talking to each other. Yeah. There's no interaction.
So we see this as something as a detriment, and that's part of what our issue is with it. We don't see it from their perspective and help them to engage it better, because they're not going to give it up. Mm-hmm. Now, this is what I found in change management, if you will, right? You've got to consider your audience. You're not, especially if there's a generational gap.
Yeah.
Right? There's a whole different way of being that we may not understand. And so we try to control, manipulate, you know, them into our world, because our world's right.
Right.
And yet, that's the exact opposite of what we ought to be doing in practicing active listening, right? Inquiring, finding out more about what's going on with them.
Mm-hmm.
And engage them, or find ways where I had one client not too long ago said, you know, I got this employee that just, I can't get him off his phone. And I said, well, you know, you've got some pages online, right? And he said, yeah. I said, well, put him to work. Let him be on this phone as long as he is helping to promote your business via social media too. Because you're not going to get him off the phone, or it's either fire him or figure out a way to work with it. So then there's this navigation and negotiation of, okay, I realize, you know, you're going to be using this, and not necessarily that you're going to have this conversation with him, right? It's okay, you're going to be doing this. How can I make use of it while you're doing this? And so there's a bridge there. Instead of the dominance control or the command and control systems that we used to have, the militaristic type, now we're understanding that, okay, there's a collaboration going on here and a way to achieve things together by talking about how you can do it together.
Yeah. You made me realize something, that I was being judgmental about these kids at the bus stop. And you also made me one of the things that you and I have in common, you mentioned earlier about organizational development. Mm-hmm. I was sort of kind of in a related career field in training and development.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
And organizational development is looking at organizational development, where training is, you know, the organizational guys, they go in, they assess the entire organization. They find out that one of the pieces that needs to be nurtured is training. And that's when I would come in and then do my needs assessment in the training. But there are some similarities with the needs assessment and so on.
It's interesting just a little side note, in the 2008 to 2010 range, when we had the dip in the economy. I was part of ASTD then. It's now the Association for Talent Development. I was on the board here in Phoenix. And at the leadership conference in Crystal City, Virginia, I ran into a bunch of other CLOs and instructional designers and those types. And they were saying, you know, it is so harsh on us now, because as these budgets are being cut, the first place they go is human resources and training development. Yeah. The most important thing in an organization. Now, this was before the notion of holistic organizational development through servant leadership began to take hold. It still hasn't yet. It's trending now,
yeah,
because they're realizing that, oh, especially with this redesign of the workforce now,
mm-hmm,
employees are more important than your company, because without them, you're not going to have a company. Yeah. Well, how do you treat your employees? How do you show that their health and well-being is more important than your bottom line?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And when you do that, your bottom line will soar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
But that's a new thing that you haven't experienced yet, because you've been doing things the old way, mm-hmm, and it's worked. Well, it doesn't work anymore.
Yeah.
And you're seeing massive, you know, what was it? I forget what it was being called, but there was this, you know, resignation, yeah, right? It's like, okay, I don't, especially with COVID and the remote working. And once they went back to the office, no, I don't want to work in your office because I don't like you.
Yeah.
You don't treat me like a human being. Why would I want to work for you?
Yeah. And along with what you said, that training is one of the first ones to get axed, because they're not looked at as a revenue generating group. That it's, you know, if you dive into it, if training is done correctly, and if the assessments are done correctly, the evaluations are done correctly, you will be able to find out, well, training is making us money, because now our sales force is more productive because of the training that we've been able to provide. Our customer service is much better because of the training. And mm-hmm, because our customer service is better, that's helping to retain customers. Our implementations are going better, easier, faster, because our implementation people are being trained better on how to be better communicators and so on. And that's all coming from what they're learning from the training department. Yep. But they don't look at it at a holistic, in a holistic way.
It's happening. It's beginning. And I've been talking about it enough on LinkedIn that I've got an organizational, top organizational development voice badge.
Okay.
I just popped up on my profile one day. I'm like, how the heck did I get this? Well, I've been talking about it quite a bit, because it really, all of this simply makes sense, right? It feels right. Mm. So then the next step would be, how do you make sense common?
Mm.
Mm. How do you find in your work now, in especially with the presentations and making that connection with your clients and with the audiences, how does that fit in? How do you bring that inner connection into an outer experience?
Great question. So how do I bring my inner connection to the
material and your audience?
So I guess, first of all, I think part of it is understanding the value of why it's important, not only to connect to the audience, but the processes that, you know, I've built a strong foundation of processes on how to connect. Now I have a better understanding. Well, it's not just talking and telling, ain't training or selling. So I've got to live this,
right?
That just getting up in front of a group of people, because that's what I did when I first started training in the Air Force, was I just got up and I was just talking, spitting, vomiting information, data at my audience. And I was learning, this isn't working. This mm-hmm. isn't sticking. People aren't learning anything. They're asking me the same questions of this same stuff that I just told them. So I had to find a better way. And once I found a better way, which it, you know, it didn't come immediately, I had to learn it.
A trial and error.
Yeah. So number one was understanding the value of it and then seeing firsthand the results of engaging an audience and seeing that that audience, I was able to have that intimate connection with them. They mm-hmm. were able to visualize what it is I'm talking about. They were now able to have an emotional connection with what I'm talking about, which at the in the end brought us all closer together. So I guess it was seeing the value.
Well, and you made one comment. I don't even think you realized how important it was. The emotional connection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep.
You don't have that. Somehow, you don't have the full experience. Because we're all, you know, we're all relationships on the ocean of emotion seeking a safe harbor, mm-hmm. right? How do we get there together? Well, mm-hmm. you bring out those emotional states and you create bonding experiences with them because they're all shared,
right?
Right? We all have the same emotions. Yeah. We all go through the same processes, although we may not be aware of it, but the fact that you mentioned, you know, you have all these processes for your foundation. Everything is a process.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We just get too impatient sometimes with it.
Yeah.
And don't know how to sit with it, go slow to go fast, right?
Mm-hmm.
To be able to recognize those key points and key elements in it that we can then grow with and flip back to the audience in the shared experience. Mm-hmm. So do you have those moments of serendipitous synchronicities with your audiences? And if so, do you recall one that is particularly poignant for our conversation?
I've had them on stage as an actor. I've had them in front of a room training people of, you know, I've had an opportunity to ask many trainers, what is it about training that you love? And they all say the same thing. It's that aha moment mm-hmm. of knowing that when you can sense or feel or right. smell
like
those
an education,
light bulbs.
We call them teachable moments.
Yeah. Yep. You see the light bulbs going
yeah.
off.
Yeah.
So to me, being in front of that audience and having them in the palm of your hand and facilitating them through a process and knowing that they're getting it, that to me is magic. The same yes. thing on stage as an actor, of having that interaction with another actor on stage where it's like playing tennis. Acting, you mentioned earlier about listening. The most important part of acting is listening. That when you throw me a line or you serve the ball to me, I have to react to that serve or to that line. I'm not just spitting words back at you. I'm listening to what you said and I'm reacting to what you said, and then I'm giving it back to you, and each of us are reacting to each other.
You're embodying it, you're not just mimicking.
Now, when I first started acting, all I was doing was listening for my cue line, and then I'd spit out my words, my lines, and then whew, got through that one. I'm going to get through the next one. But at some point it all just sunk in, and to be there and have that, it's like an orgasmic sensation of that back and forth. There's nothing like it when you know you got the audience in the palm of your hands. There's nothing else like it.
That's the energy.
Mm-hmm.
That's the energy, and it's shared. I have a friend that he calls it pure shareable energy, right? Because there's nothing else like it. It's in the moment. It's present.
Mm-hmm.
And as you can tell, it's nearly ineffable,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
right? It's just an experience that there's really no words for, because it is such a multi-sensory engagement in the process.
Mm-hmm.
So we're kind of coming up to close here. You know, we've had just a brilliant conversation. I thank you for that. Are there or is there something that you've particularly picked up on in recent times that you found to be a critical insight that you could share with others that might help them along the way?
A critical insight, I guess, it's okay to ask for help. That was something that was very difficult for me to do, to reach out for help. I finally got to a point where I did reach out for help, and it was the best thing I could have done for myself, because I have no idea where I would be today if my lifestyle had continued the way it was, it was not a healthy lifestyle at all. I don't know if I'd still be married or where the relationship with my wife would be right now. So I guess it's okay to ask for help. And I think it's also okay to get a third eye perspective on things, because what I have found for myself, I'm a coach. I'm great at coaching other people. I'm horrible at coaching myself. And my coach is able to see things that yes, they're in front of me, but I just can't see them. Mm-hmm. So asking for help, getting a different perspective, being vulnerable, all of that is okay.
Not only is it okay, it's proven to be very healthy.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Oh, David, this has been a wonderful conversation, and I thank you so much for your time, your insights, your wisdom, and sharing your life with our audience and how you've progressed. And hopefully there will be those, even just one in our audience, that connects and that finds relevance, insight, and takes a step up in their own life. That's really what it's all about, just touching one.
Thanks.
Thank you. And namaste and in La Ketch. Thanks for sticking with us for this episode of One World in a New World. I'm your host, Zen Benefiel, and I'll see you next time.